However, it's a tall order to learn an entire Sefer of Tanakh in 1 hour. The corollary to that is that you can learn all of Tanakh in about 40 hours, I guess. But we'll start with this one modest proposal today to learn 24 Prakim. I have to bide my time, so I have to get started immediately. This endeavor began with my reflection upon 25 years of teaching Introduction to Bible here at Yeshiva University. And over the years, we teach canonization, we teach the Dead Sea Scrolls, we teach archaeology, we teach Masorah, we teach Parshanut. The course used to be called an Introduction to Parshanut. Now it's called Introduction to the Bible. And I just felt, we ought to be able to teach the Bible. You leave 14, 16 years of Jewish education, our students ought to know some simple facts of Sefer Shmuel, Sefer Malachim, not to mention who Habakkuk and Yoel and Nochum and Zephaniah were, any one message that each of these Nevi'im have given in their illustrious past. Therefore, I began the course with 1 week, possibly a week and a half, of simple introduction to the Sfarim from Yahushua to Divrei Hayamim, and today I'd like to spend our time on Shmuel Bet, just as an attempt to show how this could be done. I dare say our 9, 10, 12-year-old students can sit through a 3-hour baseball game and afterwards wrap up the entire game. They can tell you who hit the home runs, who was caught stealing. How do they remember all these things? They watch a 2-hour movie. They can remember details of the movie because they were paying close attention. Now, in Halavai, our 9 and 10 and 12-year-olds can pay the close attention that the adults who came here took a trip to specially to learn. We first have to invest them with the enthusiasm to learn, to acquire this information. So I take no further time on this, and I begin with Chapter 1. Chapter 1 of Shmuel Bet requires us, and of course you'll understand that I will be speaking very quickly. If you're taking notes, do so quickly. Shmuel Bet is a continuation of the end of Shmuel Aleph, where Shaul commits suicide rather than fear the upcoming wrath of the Plishtim. They were not good conquerors. Shaul was afraid he's Halalubi. And there is a different story given in the beginning of Shmuel Bet. While Shaul falls on his sword, an Amaleki lad tells David that I saw him leaning on a spear. And he tells David that Shaul begged me, the shavots, the agony has gripped me, and I started to take my own life, but now I need you to finish me off. The lad does so. The Rambam actually explains in Hilchos Melachim that David's response in killing the lad was hora'as Shaul, not allowed to kill on someone's own admission. David, later in the book, it would appear, did not believe that this lad was telling the truth. The reader, the critical reader of Perek Aleph, can tell that the lad is not telling the truth. There was not enough time from when the archers found David at the end of Shmuel Aleph to where he decided to take his own life for the lad to do everything he said he did. But he was in possession of David's crown and of Shaul's crown and 2 bracelets. How did he get them? Lechora Shaul was hiding and was hiding his identity. You don't wear your crown when you're hiding from the enemy. You don't want them to catch you. You let someone else wear the crown, maybe. Or you'd stash them someplace. The lad obviously must have found them and tried to curry favor with David by indicating that I killed your enemy. That is a very important point that will come up 2 more times in the very beginning of this book. People think they will curry favor with David for ridding the kingdom of any remnant of Shaul's dynasty. And David very diplomatically shows that that is wrong. I am not happy with the death of Shaul. Chazal tell us that when someone dies, that ends up being good news for you because you will inherit. You say Baruch Dayan Emes, and then you say Shechianu. Some say after the funeral, whatever it might be. But if you make these 2 brachas, David should say Shechianu now. I'm king. I'm the undisputed king. But not so fast. There is still a remnant of Shevet Binyamin that wants a descendant of Shaul to be king. David shows everyone in Klal Yisrael by singing a long dirge over Shaul and his sons at the end of Perek Aleph that I am not happy with this unfolding events. And yet, at this time, David feels he will be the undisputed king of Israel, but it's not to be. Avner, the power behind Shaul's throne at this time, appoints Shaul's son, Ishbosheth, as the next king of Israel. Ishbosheth rules over 11 tribes. David simply rules over Yehuda alone. And Ishbosheth is chosen for a number of svaros. One can be that Avner is simply loyal to his first king. He feels, why shouldn't his son rule after him? He's loyal, and even though everyone in Israel knew that David is better king material than Ishbosheth, this is a political fact, that usually you would prefer someone to rule who will be better for you, for your pocket, for your interests. People usually vote their own interests, not necessarily the interests of all of Klal Yisrael. And Avner surely should have chosen David king. However, Tosfos in the Seches Sanhedrin says Avner was doing something much more than this. There was a prophecy to Yaakov, Umelochim mechalotzecha yetzeu. Kings shall yet come from you, Hashem told Yaakov in Parshas Vayishlach, and only Binyamin was not yet born. There was a Mesorah that two kings should come from Binyamin, and that's it. Then Lo Yosef Shevet Yehuda. So Avner, Tosfos says, was simply fulfilling this prophecy by appointing Ishbosheth king. But everyone in Israel knew that David was better material. They say so themselves in chapter 5, that they knew it back in Shmuel Aleph. So why didn't they do something about it when Shaul was chasing after David at every turn? That's politics also. You don't stick out your neck for someone else if you think that doing so will have yourself killed, as Shaul showed throughout Shmuel Aleph. So what Israel was left to do at this time was to have a competition between representatives of David's side and representatives of Shaul's side, and they do this. They say, let us have a competition. The purpose of this competition is to show which side is better capable of securing us from the Plishtim. This is also a very famous political fact, and I believe it will demonstrate itself in the politics in this country itself. The next president of this country, like Shmuel Beis, Perek Beis, wants to teach us, will be the one that will be able to convince the majority of this electorate in this country that you will be more secure if I am president. All other things stand in the background if you're worried about the Plishtim at your door. So this competition in chapter 2 is for the purpose of seeing which side is better, will better serve the nation. David's side has one of their own, Asael, a very fleet-footed one, chasing after the captain of Shaul's side. The captain tells him, turn right or left, you're chasing after someone who's too big for you. I'm the chief of this side, go chase after someone else. That chase seems to indicate that the purpose of this competition was simply to see whose soldiers are stronger, faster, whose soldiers can capture the flag or capture the other side. Asael does not turn aside, Avner plants himself, and Asael runs very quickly into something sharp, a sword or some sharp stick, and he is immediately killed. It says that he killed him in the Chomesh, the fifth rib, which kills immediately. He's one of four people killed in this book in the Chomesh. This will come politically, have something to do with where Yoav behaves later. And while the competition was 12 against 12, there apparently were many spectators, and many, many people started to take part, like a rowdy soccer game at the end of the game. And it ended up that 380 people ended up dying as a result of this. 360 from Shaul's side, 20 from David's side, and all of Israel could see from this competition that David's side is better suited for us. That leads us into chapter 3, where David's first six children are mentioned with their wives. And in chapter 3, Ishbosheth does something very stupid. He accuses Avner of a scandal. Why have you taken the former Pelegesh of my father Shaul? Whether it's true or not, I can't imagine he would fabricate such a claim, but it was foolish of him because now Avner said, I don't need these accusations. I will turn to the other side and I will conciliate the dynasty with David. Once Avner turns over to David's side, there is no more hope for Ishbosheth. And Avner's turn to David's side is not good news for Yoav. Because Yoav at this point is David's nephew and chief of staff, and Avner is about to take his job. Yoav also hates Avner because he just killed my brother. And Yoav tells David explicitly, it's the same thing, like if you recall, if let's say an Iranian pilot would somehow land a plane in Israel now and say, I want to give you all the secrets of Iran, wouldn't we be frightened? Do we want to be sure that this person is not a double agent? Yoav accuses Avner of just that. He's coming to see your inner movements, and he's going to report them to Ishbosheth so he can kill you. Don't take this, Avner, on your side. And David says, I hear you, but you're too hot-headed, Yoav. Avner can serve my purposes very well, and David is ingenious. He says, if you want to come to my side, deliver me Michal. Michal was taken from David back in Shmuel Aleph when Shaul started to hate David and said, you will not be the wife of my enemy. And he gives her to someone else named Palti ben Laish. So David says, if you deliver me Michal, I'll take you on my side. This is ingenious. One, it gets back his wife. Whether he loved her or not, that's a separate question. But certainly having Michal on David's side at this point is a very positive development for him. It unites the two kingdoms. In fact, the Malbim says in chapter 5 that that's why David moved his kingdom from Hebron to Yerushalayim. Hebron is in the south of Yehuda, Yerushalayim in the north. Besides all the Midrashim you've heard about how Yerushalayim was chosen from the time of Bias HaOlam and the Kedis Yitzchak, David says Yerushalayim is just at the border of the first kingdom of Binyamin. It will make Binyamin feel more part of my new kingdom, which certainly his return of Michal would do, but also, very important, it is certain that Ish-bosheth does not want Michal to be returned to David. What is the relationship between Ish-bosheth and Michal? They're brother and sister. They're both children of Shaul. If Avner can deliver Michal to David... I'm okay. Everyone okay in the back? If Avner can deliver Michal to David, that is a sign that Avner is indeed the true power on that side, and it serves me to have him on my side. David accepts him. And of course, let me tell you a message in Shmuel Bet. Do not cross Yoav. Everyone who crosses Yoav in Shmuel Bet gets the Chomesh treatment. Avner goes up to David to Yoav, and he secludes himself with Yoav. Yoav, according to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, asks him some shilas about Chalitza, and Avner responds, and Yoav kills him in the Chomesh. And the obvious question is, Avner, you're a seasoned soldier. You're much older than Yoav. Surely you know you just killed his brother a few weeks ago. You're about to replace him. He's accusing you of being a spy. You don't realize that he's going to kill you if you're in seclusion with him? How could a trained soldier allow this to happen? And the answer is that Avner could not fathom that Yoav would so compromise David's new kingdom by making it seem to the average Israelite that David ordered this hit. Yoav is David's chief. Yoav is David's nephew. Yoav ben Tsruya. Tsruya was not his father. Tsruya is Yoav's mother, who is David's sister. So Yoav compromised David. And that's why, if you look at the end of Perek Gimel, David sings a dirge in Perek Gimel that is even greater than the one in Perek Aleph for Yonah's son and his friend and for his father-in-law. Because he had to show Israel, I was not behind this. And it actually says after his dirge, and all of Israel could see, David was not behind the hit on Avner. Why didn't he kill Yoav for this, the way he killed the Amaleki in Perek Aleph? Probably because Yoav's mother, David's sister, didn't let him. She came to cry to him and said, don't do this to my son. Otherwise, David, based on his behavior and the rest of Shmuel Bet, probably would have killed him for it. In fact, that's just what he does in Perek Dalet. Perek Dalet is a very short perek that describes Shaul's surviving grandson, a crippled Mephibosheth. Why he's there, Rashi says, is because, just a small little description, Yonasan had one surviving grandchild whose nursemaid dropped him while they were fleeing the Philistines. So usually when they kill a king, they kill every surviving relative. This one managed to escape. And it just tells us how sad and sorry the rest of Binyamin is becoming, the rest of Shaul's kingdom is becoming. So then chapter 4 continues with the murder of Ish-bosheth after 2 years on the throne. He's taking a nap in the afternoon. Not good for anyone in Tanakh. Any person in Tanakh who takes a nap in the afternoon, a person of leadership, always meets a bad ending. There are 4 such stories, and this is Ish-bosheth. He is killed on his deathbed, his afternoon nap bed, by 2 of his own relatives from Binyamin, who present David with the head this time. At least the Amaleki just presented him with a crown. He presents him with the head, thinking, now here is your enemy, your last impediment for you being king. And David kills them for their regicide, for killing a king. So this is now is what paves David's way for to be the one sole king, to act in an imperial manner, to be the undisputed king of Israel. The Bnei Israel come to him and say, we knew even when Shaul was king that you were the undisputed king, that you were the one who emotes you, maybe. You were the one who was saving us from the Plishtim, even as Shaul was using badly needed forces to kill you. We knew you were the right one. That's a sad political factor that I mentioned before. David could turn to them. It's not in the Tanakh, but he could turn to them and say, oh yeah? Why didn't you say so back in Shmuel Aleph? Right? But that's a sad fact. And that's what it is. So in chapter 5, there's an amazing amazingly cryptic story in chapter 5 that involves the conquest of Yerushalayim, and we can only really know what this conquest is about by comparing Divrei HaYomim with the Shmuel text. Because from Shmuel alone, we don't really know what David is doing. The two texts together indicate as follows, that David was offering the head of the army to the one who could cut off the water supply of the Jebusites, who lived in Yerushalayim at that time. Yerushalayim, you know, does not have a natural water supply, and now we can go on the tunnel tours, and they can show you exactly where they feel that Yoav cut off the supply to the Yebusim, in which case it was a very easy siege to defeat them. Part of that siege involves David saying, I want nothing to do with those crippled and blind people. Do not ever bring them to my table. This is such a cryptic section. There are so many attempts at explaining this. Rashi quotes a medrash that says that it refers to their Avodah Zarah, but it's hard to fathom why they themselves, the Jebusites themselves, would refer to their Avodah Zarah as blind and crippled, because at first they do. Abravanel suggests that what they were saying was, even our blind and crippled idols, statues, can protect this city from you. It's impenetrable. So, but that doesn't explain why David himself says, I don't want to see any blind or crippled people ever again in my palace. Why would he hate them? Just because they referred to their Avodah Zarah as blind and crippled? Rather, we have on archaeological data that the Jebusites and some others fought battles by putting weak and lame people in the front lines, and the soldiers advanced, crouched behind them. Very similar to the Arabs today shooting from nurseries or hospitals or mosques, and Israel sees where the shooting is coming from, they shoot from far away, they don't know where it's. The reconnaissance picks up this place, they shoot in, and then they escape from there, and they say, look, the Israelis are shooting at nurseries and hospitals. Very similar tactic, where they creep behind the blind and the crippled, and then David just is watching them, and he said, what can I do? He had to shoot at them. It's not the thing a soldier likes to do, but I had to shoot arrows at them. So every time David would see a blind or crippled person, he was reminded, a very psychological kind of perish, he was reminded of this unfortunate event, and he said, don't bring them to my palace, which may explain why he was inconsiderate of the crippled Mephibosheth at the end of Shmuel Beis. But we'll get to that shortly. Chapter 6, now that David rules in Yerushalayim, it's time to bring the Aron home. The Aron has been in the home of a man named Avinadav for 20 years, blessing his home, since it's been taken back in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, for goodness sakes. And David takes it and puts it inexplicably on the cart of cows, the way the Plishtim delivered it back in Shmuel Aleph. Bravanel says that David might have thought that only in the Midbar it had to be carried on the shoulders of Levium, but when we bring it to Israel, it can be carried any way we wish. And while this was happening, the inexplicable event of the Aron shaking off, and the son of Abinadav, Uzzah, saw it falling, propped it back up, and immediately died. David is beyond words. This is the Haftorah of the story of the death of Nadav and Avihu. Perhaps another inexplicable story, but there at least Nadav and Avihu had a chance to ask a shaila. Al shehoru halacha b'fnei rabam. They didn't ask a shaila. They could have asked, is this a good fire? Is this a good way to do it? But for goodness sakes, Uzzah didn't have a second to think. What should anyone do? So I suggest, Rashi says that he should have known from Sefer Yehoshua that the Aron carried the Kohanim across the Yarden, so the Aron could carry others, surely it could carry himself. You'll forgive me. What if Uzzah learnt this drash like the Radak, who said that's not what the Pasuk means in Yehoshua? Or even if he agreed with Rashi, in Sefer Yehoshua, what if he forgot that Medrash at that moment? Or he didn't know that Medrash? Or he knew the Medrash, and if he had 3 seconds to think about it, and someone said, oh, look at that, there's the Aron falling. And he said, oh yeah, well, I remember in Shir once, I heard that. He didn't have a second to think of it, even if he knew the Medrash and agreed with the Medrash. Why is he punished for pushing it up? So the Yerushalmi and Sota, apparently might be aware of such a medrash, gives an amazing different interpretation. It's hard to say in public. Yerushalmi says, you know, he was traveling for a long time with the Aron. What happens when you're traveling a long time? He had to relieve himself. What should he do? He's worrying, what should I do? Kavod HaBriyah, should I just relieve myself here in my own, just by myself, like this, on my body? Kavod HaBriyah, so I'm moving the Aron. What should I do? Should I go Klapei Ha'om, away from the Aron, in front of all these people accompanying the Aron? Or is it better not to have a shander? The Gemara says you shouldn't spit in public because it's a shander on the public. So he chose, at the moment, to relieve himself Mashdin Bakir, on the side of the Aron. And that's why he died. Now that seems to be the Rishonim clutching at straws. There's no hint to the fact that this is the case. Where does it say in the text that he did this? It says what he did. So what the Yerushalmi is saying, he did a different thing. It says in the Torah that Reuven vayishkav es bilah, and we have a tradition he did something else. It says he pushed up the aron. We have a tradition. The Yerushalmi says that he did something else. I would suggest, and I must tell you, what I'm about to tell you, I leave it up to you. You can reject, you can throw it out if you want. It's original. And I said in the drasha last year on Parshas Shmini, forgive me if anyone here heard that drasha in the room at the time. It has to do with a terrible disease called Munchausen's disorder. And I suggest this because if you look at how the Aron slips, the Tanakh seems to indicate that Uzzah wanted it to slip and was waiting for it to slip. Because I'll challenge anyone in this room to paraphrase in English what happened that day. Just paraphrase in English. Uzzah was walking alongside the Aron. Now just tell me, Lefitumchem, what happened then? How would you write it in the Tanakh? What happened? Uzzah was walking alongside the Aron with his family members and... No, help me.
He sees
it slipping and
he
reaches to push it up. That's not what's written in the Tanakh. The Tanakh says he was walking alongside the Aron. He pushed his hand to push the Aron up because it began slipping. How does it say it that way? First tell me what happened and then tell me the solution. Tell me it started to slip, he recognized it, and he did what anyone would do on the moment. Munchausen's disorder is a terrible disease whereby, especially in the medical field, sometimes parents do it. You want someone to suffer who's in your care. You want to bring about a negative situation so that you can be the hero of saving that situation. You hear it, nurses, they're given the wrong medication. The person is going into cardiac arrest, and the nurse comes in and says, looks at, oh my goodness, that's the wrong thing. And they say, and the family says, how did you know that? How did you know to look there? How did you save his life? And they give him a gift, and they give him, not realizing that person purposely did it this way. So I'm just suggesting this. I know it's a shot in the air, but no, I have a problem. I have a problem with why Hashem is punishing someone unduly, and I have a problem with all the various mafarshim. Ha'enosh me'eloi yitzdok, says Eob's friends, so this is my interpretation. And that is the impediment to David bringing the Aron back home because David stops the celebration. The death of Nadav and Avihu doesn't stop the celebration of the Mishkan, but this stops the celebration of the return to Yerushalayim, and he leaves the Aron where it is, only to bring it back later. Chapter 7, David just feels the very next thing to do is, there's a formula in the Torah for when you have to build the Beis HaMikdash. It says, when I have separated you, misaviv, from all of your enemies, then it's time to build me a Mishkan, build me a house in my special city. So David has the city, the Perek starts off, he was freed from all his enemies and all his wars, so it's time to build a house. The Navi makes a tragic mistake. Many people forget about one pasuk in the middle. The Navi tells him, David, you can do it, whatever your heart desires, God will make you matzliach. And the next morning, the poor prophet has to come back and tell David what he learned overnight. By the way, God says I was wrong. You can't build this house. David went to sleep that night joyful that he was going to build the house. And when he hears in the morning that he can't, David responded in a very magnanimous manner because he said, your son will build it. From this we learn in Gemara in Sanhedrin, a person is never jealous of his son. My son's accomplishments are my accomplishments. Okay? So in chapter 8, we're told something that is very unusual. We're told that David is fighting wars again. Wait a second. In chapter 7, it said David had no more wars to fight. That's why he could build the Beis HaMikdash. Now in chapter 8, you have more wars. And David is extremely cruel in these wars. Rashi, in the beginning of chapter 8, says that I don't understand how David can be this cruel to the Moabites. His own people. And Rashi explains as follows. Back in Shmuel Aleph, where Shaul made a message of any nation, any city that helped David. Right? The Kohanim helped him. They killed off the whole city. So no city wanted to help David. That political point I mentioned earlier. So David had no place to send no place to turn. He went to the Eretz Plishtim, because maybe they thought, well, if he's Shaul's enemy, maybe there's another political fact, the enemy of my enemy will be my friend. Right? So that doesn't work because they say isn't he the one who killed Goliath, who happened to be the brother of the king at that time. So David had to flee to Plishtim. Where else could he go? At that point, Shaul was looking for David's family. And he was going to take them hostage and say, you give yourself up or I'll start to kill your family members. So he took his family to Moab. I'm not telling you Medrash now, this is in Shmuel Aleph. He took his family to Moab and he told them, when it's safe, I will call for you. He never calls for them. Chazal say that the Moabites killed his entire family. According to one Perush, a sister survived, Avigail, who was saved by the king of Ammon. We'll come back to that shortly. Another Perush says that his brother Shimi survived. And if you're following the Daf Yomi, he was mentioned just a few days ago in the Daf as an ancestor, Friday, as an ancestor of one of the Tanoim. Anyway, so at this point, David was especially cruel to the Moabites because of what they did to his family. But the problem is, as Abravanel points out, how does Perek 7 say he's free from his enemies, and Perek 8 says he's fighting wars? So Abravanel just says, Ein Mukta Mamuchar. Chapter 8 is really after chapter 6, right? 6, 8, 7. And then chapter 9, David wants to return a promise that he made to Yonatan, that he would look after his children. Now, David also made this promise to Shaul that he would look after his grandchildren. Shaul, the second time when he saw David, who had the opportunity to kill Shaul and didn't, he said, promise me one thing. I know you're going to be king. Just promise me that you will not kill my grandchildren when you become king. Now, if you're David, what would you answer? How would you answer that question? Promise me you will not kill my grandchildren when you become king. What would you say? What? You should say, I don't intend to become king. You're wrong about me all this time. You should lie. He does intend to become king. Shmuel crowned him. But he's been hiding that all along, right? He never tells anybody. How can you think I'm not, I want you to know I don't intend to become king? Instead, David slips. He says, I promise, I will not kill your grandchildren. Shaul then turns to his men and says, I told you he wants to become king. Shaul doesn't keep his promise. That's why in chapter 9, when it says, David looked after Yonatan's children because of the promise he made to Yonatan. You can say, wait a second, he made that same promise to Shaul. He wasn't bound by his promise to Shaul because Shaul that day went back on it. David is bound by his promise to Yonatan and he looks after Yonatan's crippled son, Mephibosheth, chapter 9. He gives him a huge mansion. He gives him a servants, 35 servants to look after him. 20 servants and 15 children of Tziva to look after him. 35 servants to look after this one crippled boy and says, anytime you want, you can stay here in my palace. Now, Abravanel and Rashi both ask, why is this here all of a sudden in chapter 9? Why didn't David do this in chapter 2, chapter 6, or as soon as he became king? What happened now that makes David want to keep his promise to Yonatan? So, if you say that chapter 8 is where it belongs, at the end of chapter 8, there's a description of David's cabinet, all the people who are helping him run the country. So David, according to this sheet that holds, listen, look at all these people helping me run a great country, and Shaul, what happened to his kingdom? 2 years, another 2 years for his son. Well, poor Shaul. Oh, let me look after his grandson. Let me look after Yonatan's son. So, however, I don't think this is the preferable interpretation, because I think that you should connect chapter 9 not to 8, but to 7. Remember, it's 6, 8, 7, 9. What happens at the end of chapter 7 moves very well into chapter 9. David is told, you won't build this temple, but your son will. Right? So he's saying, oh, my son, my kingdom is going to last. I'm going to give it on to his son. Oh, poor Shaul. Look who he gave his kingdom to Ishbosheth. The only surviving relative is Mephibosheth, a cripple. Let me look after him. How did David not know about the whereabouts? He had to ask amongst the kingdom, where is Yonatan's children? For goodness sakes, they're his nephews and nieces. Yonatan is his brother-in-law. How does he not know about his family members? So Rashi says because they were afraid that they'd be killed by David. A fear that was not well-founded, but a fear in reality, because David would look after them. But you can excuse them for thinking so. Remember, the people who killed Ishbosheth thought that David would be happy with the head of a son of Shaul. So you could excuse the grandsons of Shaul themselves of thinking that David might harbor such a murderous and vengeful intention for them, and they were in hiding until David made known to everyone, I will not harm a descendant of Shaul. By the way, it's very interesting to contrast the small cabinet of four men who helped David run the country with the cabinet in Malachim Aleph, Perek Dalid, of the 30 or so men who helped Shlomo run his very bloated government. Remember, I don't mean to take sides in any political issue in America here, but in Malachim Aleph, what brings down the kingdom of Yehuda is taxes. He overtaxed the people. They said, lower the taxes and we'll serve you, they said to Rehavam. But just to contrast who was running David's kingdom, a small few people, three or four people, and you look a whole parak in chapter 4 of Malachim Aleph, it's an interesting contrast. So David is saying, oh, look at this, my son is going to build a temple, look what happened to Shaul's son, Shaul's grand, and that's what made him think in chapter 9, to help Mephibosheth. And that was his recompense for his good friend. Chapter 10 is a chapter out of nowhere. David just says, you know what? The king of Ammon just died. He did me a toiva. This toiva is never mentioned in all of Tanakh. Not in Divrei Yomim, not in Shmuel Aleph. What did the king of Ammon do for David? That David should give, return this favor. So Rashi makes reference to the Psikta that says about the story before, that Ammon was killing off David's family, and the king of Ammon named Moab was killing off his family. The king of Ammon named Nochosh saved David's sister. That's why in Divrei Yomim she's called Avigail Bas Nochosh. There's one medrash that says that Nochosh was really Yishai, Gemara Masechet Shabbos, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that she was called Bas Nochosh because the king of Ammon really named Nochosh. Remember, he's the one in Shmuel Aleph who wanted to remove the right eye of all those the people of Yabesh Gilad. So this is the tova that the king of Ammon did. David sends emissaries to attend the funeral, a state funeral, and what did they do? A crazy story. They cut off half their beards. They cut off their pants in a shameful manner, and they make them walk in public like that. Why? Because the king of Ammon was convinced that these are spies coming to see the inside of your country to conquer. Wait a second. That's what you do to spies? You shame them, and then you let them run home and give their information over? That's the punishment? That's crazy. Surely the king of Ammon did not think that these were genuine spies. They wouldn't let them go home. You shame them, and then you kill them. You don't shame them and let them go home. So what's the pshat? The Ammonites wanted to fight David at this time, but they wanted the papers to write that David is the aggressor. Sound familiar? Ammon wanted, they felt that this will lead to, or this is an aggression that has to be answered. And David indeed went to war here, and in that war, the Maisa with Bathsheba took place. And the Tanchum in Pinchas says, David, great sins start off as little sins. There's a reason why the Torah says Lo tidrosh l'shlomam betova samad olam, that you're not allowed to send peace to Ammon and Moab. The little sin of sending peace led to this whole story. So along comes the Yireim in his Sefer Yireim, and he says, wait a second, the Torah says Lo tidrosh l'shlomam, you're not allowed to pursue peace with Ammon. David was returning. Look at the story. It says the king made me a chesed, and we need the tradition to tell us what the chesed was, but it doesn't matter. It says there's a chesed. I'm returning the chesed. I'm not the drosh l'shlomam, not the drisha of the shalom. I'm returning the shalom. So that, according to the Yireim, is the solution. If you look in Hilchos Malachim on the Isser of sending peace to Ammon and Moab, the Kesef Mishnah refers to this Yireim, and he says, why is the Yireim so anxious to absolve David of guilt when the Tanchum and Pinchas already says he's guilty? I don't know, because it's a mitzvah to do so. I don't know, but anyway, you see the Ayin Sham in the Kesef Mishnah in Hilchos Malachim. So the insolence of the king of Ammon is responded by David in this way. He fights, and in that war, where that's why the Gemara says Kol Yotzi L'Mechemes Beis David Get Krisus Yenosin L'Ishto. Well, where is Uriah at battle? In this battle, he's fighting the Ammonites. So David sees Bathsheba in the beginning of the story, and we all know that unfortunate episode. Now Chazal tell us that in the Gemara in Ksuvas Daf Tes, the real kasha of David is that if he did such a thing, as the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Daled, the Gemara in Perek Chelek, say the whole point of writing this story out and not omitting it from Tanakh, because that's what David wanted to have happen, right? David begged, "Vini kasi mi pesha rav," take the whole story out of Tanakh. So Hashem says, no, I have to keep it in Tanakh so that people can see how to do tshuva. That's why good teachers of Shmuel Beis always teach that chapter with Tehillim Perek Nun Aleph, which is all about David's response that starts off Bevoi Love Nosna Novi Kashabal Abbas Shova. So you have to see what's the purpose of recording it in Tanakh. Hashem says, how can I take it out of Tanakh? The Yud of Sorai fetched to me until I put him back into Yoshua's name. How can I take a whole two prokim out of Tanakh? But the fact is, Hashem tells two things. He says, I'll have it written in Shmuel Beis so that people will recognize that you're not as bad as it seems in the text. And I will have it out of Divrei Hayom. Divrei Hayom makes no reference to Bathsheba at all. And the Gemara in Ksuvah says two terutzim of how, not how could David do such a thing, two terutzim of how David could maintain his relationship with her after, if she's Asura L'Baal, Asura L'Boel. The answer is, if she was not Asura L'Baal, Because the first teretz in the Gemara is ones shani, which means he took her against her will, in which case she was not rendered forbidden to Uriah, therefore she's not forbidden to David afterwards. But this makes David look worse than the biblical text. It seems she comes to him willingly. It says, Vatavoi love. Right? But that's one teretz, and it's a teretz halachically used by famous cases over the years, a Mishnah Lamelech, who says that if this is the case, she can actually go to the person who took her after the husband divorces her or dies, because of this teretz of the Gemara. However, the more famous teretz is the one found in Masechah Shabbos, that kolal yotze lemelchemes beis David get krisus yonosim leishto. And there's good pshat in Shmuel Aleph that when the Jews were at war, it was in Shaul's war though, but Mestama David did the same, that it says the husbands sent tokens to their wives to be used in battle. That was the gittin, just in case you shouldn't be an aguna if I am not returned with everyone else. Problem with this perush, says Rabbeinu Tam and Dafnun Ches in Maseches Bava Metzia, is that David tries to cover up the story by doing what? By sending Uriah home, so that people will think that he's the father of the child. That's the worst thing David should want to do under these circumstances of Ksuvas Daf Tes and Shabbos Daf Nun Vav. Then the Mafreya, your act, which is now not adulterous if he doesn't come home, but if he comes home, there's a new date on the get. Your act will certainly be considered adulterous. And even certainly according to Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara in Ksuvas, later in Ksuvas, who says that in the time in between, she's considered a full Eishes Ish while her husband is still fighting in the battle. Right? Be that as it may, Rabbeinu Tam in that Taisvus and Bava Metzia says that the kings, that the men gave full gittin. Bathsheba was a divorced free woman at that time. Rabbeinu Tam just has a bigger problem. Why did David have to have him killed then? Just take him and say, listen, Uri, I have a good news and bad news. The good news is you're gonna have 20 houses, you never have to pay taxes for the rest of your life. The bad news is that the wife you were hoping to remarry after the battle, she's not available. So why did David have to have him killed? That's a teretz that Rabbeinu Tam would have to answer someplace else. But anyway, this is what happens, and it seems that at the end of the story, the thing that irks Hashem most is the cover-up of it all. That at the end, David looks quite good. It seems, except for one little medrash in the Gemara and Shabbos, Daf Kuf Dalet, that no one in Israel knew about this. It was totally covered up. Right? If Avshalom had known about it, he wouldn't have used Mishpat as the source of his rebellion. He would have used this Maisa. Anyway, in chapter 12, the prophet comes to him and accuses him in a beautiful, beautiful Agadita, Mesech HaSukkah, Daf Nun Vav. The prophet accuses him by pointing his finger and saying, Atah Ish, you're the man who did this thing. But he tells him, he can't go to him at first to accuse him, because after all, David is still king. He tells him a parable. Listen carefully to the parable. There are two men in your kingdom, a rich man and a poor man. The rich man has many sheep. The poor man just has one sheep. And he goes to describe the relationship between this man and his sheep in very unusual terms. He sleeps with him, he eats at his table, he eats with his children, drinks from his cup, really crazy. So David might be thinking at this time, get on with it. What happened? So he said, okay, this is what happened. The rich man had a halech, listen carefully, the rich man had a halech come to his house, and he refused to take of his own sheep to give to the oreach who came to his house. Rather, he took the one sheep that belonged to the poor man to the ish haba'elov. Now, if the rich man is David, the poor man is Uriah, the sheep is Bathsheba. Who is the guest? That's what Sukkah Daf Nun Beit is all about. So all Agadot is about the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara first starts off as a halach. It walks by. When David saw her bathing, he should have moved. Oh my goodness, I'm walking away. There was nothing wrong with David being on his gog to see it. From where we know the topography, you could see the whole area leading down to that place called Silwan and near David now and Shimon HaTzadik. David could see down, but it's okay. You're allowed to walk on your patio. It's her fault. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says she was bathing behind the screen. She was at the mikveh. Because the pasuk says right after, "Bimiskadeshes mitumasa." For goodness' sake, says the Abravanel, if this was adultery, nida is the least of his problems. She was not a nida. The pasuk says you can't just call her in the street. Maybe she's not in the right time. But it says, "Bimiskadeshes mitumasa." That was if she was going to mikvah on the roof. The mikvahs were on the roofs then, but they had big screens, and the screen just fell down. And David was innocently standing on his roof. Some of Forshim want to say that David shouldn't have even been there at the time. That's why, because later in the story, Avshalom takes his ten pilakshim they left behind, and he says he raped them on the same roof that David saw Bathsheba, implying that there was something wrong with the original story. But I don't think we need to go there. David was doing something innocent. When the Yetzer Hara was just a halach, he should have walked away. He stayed. The Yetzer Hara became an oreach, and then the Yetzer Hara became an ish. It's very easy to banish a halach from your house. Say, listen, I got to go. I didn't know you were coming. Goodbye. When you invite him, he's a guest. He said, a guest is invited. I'm sorry, I have to go now. But then Ish, he's paying rent already. He's living in your head. Right? So there it's very difficult to banish. And David pronounces the death penalty and to pay fourfold for the sheep. Kim le medrabnine. Kill the man and pay fourfold, for goodness sakes. He recognizes Torah law about killing a sheep. And Chazal says, Mar Yuma, that because you spoke this way, you will lose four children yourself. So quick to pronounce judgment on someone else. So there are two different deos who the four children are, but you see, David loses children. The rest of Shmuel Beis, there's a response to these things. And the child born of this deed dies as well, and that's one of the four. And immediately afterwards, we see the function of this misdeed, where David's, the prophet tells him, Nassan tells him, you did two terrible things. You broke up a family, Bathsheba and Uriah, and you used the sword of Ammon to do it. David wins every battle in Shmuel Beis until he arranges to lose one, and then everything falls apart. And the prophet tells him, for the rest of your life, one of these two things will happen. Either your family will fall apart, or you'll be chased by a sword. Sometimes both together, as in the case of Avshalom. The first one is chapter 13, the terribly repulsive story of a son of David falling in love with a daughter of David. And you could think that, it's David's oldest son, Amnon. The kingdom is waiting for him. Any woman in Israel is waiting for him. He has to fall in love with one who he can't have, his sister. Now, Chazal tells the Gemara in Sanhedrin that actually this girl, Tamar, was converted. She and her mother, Macha, were taken from the king of Geshur. The Macha was the daughter of the king of Geshur. And she was the Ashes Yafas Toar. And not only could Tamar actually marry Amnon, she could marry even her much closer brother, Avshalom, because she had converted. And she's like a Tinoke Shinolda, and therefore she could even marry Avshalom, with whom she shared a father and a mother. Tosfos in the second parak in Sanhedrin suggests that actually Avshalom and Tamar only shared the same mother. Tamar and Avshalom and Amnon didn't share any parent. They were step siblings who could marry, which is why she says in the middle of the story, when he expresses his love for her, she says, please don't take me like this. We don't do this in Israel. Ask for my hand in marriage. Our father will not keep me from you. In the middle of the parak. So some of Farshim say she was just stalling. She was saying, go to the father, ask for my hand. And when David hears this, he's going to say, what? If I see you within the same city as Tamar, you'll never become the same king. By that time, she's saved. But instead, he wanted her, be'isser. It's very clear. He's the example in Pirkei Avos of Ava Shetluya Bedavar. Chazal say she did a terrible thing to him there, and therefore he had no Ava for her anymore. He couldn't do that anymore. Use your imagination. Chafala from Aleph, seven lines from the bottom on the Sechas Sanhedrin. I can't tell you here what she did to him. Anyway, so Lamaisa, though, his advice, the advice given to him about what to do, was from a man, the only person in all of Tanakh called Chacham Me'od. Even Shlomo is not called Chacham Me'od. Only one person, this wicked Yonadav, who was his cousin of Tamar and cousin of Amnon, gives Amnon advice to rape your sister? What kind of smart? How could the Tanakh call him Chacham Me'od? And let me please tell you, although this is not under the realm of Chazal, I would like to judge Yonadav Bekavschus. Yonadav never tells Amnon to take your sister. He tells him to establish an elaborate plan of her cooking for you, making levivot for you, the word lev is in it, making some pancakes, and then you'll do what you have to do. Right now, according to this, I would like to use some Freudian twists in this. What Yonadav's plan was, because he can't just tell his friend, you sick puppy you, how dare you even think of your sister? Now, I have to assume that a Chacham Me'od person is only going to act in a way that is in his best interests. And the best interests of Yonadav is that his best friend, Amnon, becomes the next king, of course. So he's not going to give him advice that's going to keep him from becoming the next king, but he also has to be very careful how he tells him that advice. He can't just tell him, you sick man, you. The same way Natan had to go to David in an honorable way, he has to tell him in a smart, very smart way, how you can do something which will make you turn your attention away from your sister. Let her come to your house, let her wear an apron, let her put on the fire, let her mix the batter. And he tells him at great length, look in that story. You have to tell him all the things. He knows, she knows how to make an omelet. But she tells him how to do these things. Let her do this and then you'll know what to do. He was hoping that if he sees her with this apron on, sweating over the fire, perhaps looking a little fat with the apron on, we'll look at cooking this food. You know, and he'll say, that's not my an object of love, that's my mother there. Maybe he'll look at her in a different light and be as they say, grossed out by the way she looks. And there is his chokhmah. At the end of the story, when David hears that Avshalom killed Amnon, for one of two reasons, to avenge his sister, and also because, remember, Avshalom is very conveniently placed as the next in line to be king. I get rid of Amnon, hey, father was told that he can't build a Beis HaMikdash because he's a man of war. Who will build a Beis HaMikdash? Your son, who's a man of peace. Avshalom. It's me. He doesn't realize that he has a brother named Shlomo also, but still, he's Avshalom. I'm going to be the next king, and all I have to do is get rid of Amnon. And to do so under the cover of vengeance for my sister. I can get away with this. And he does. And when David thinks that Avshalom killed all of his sons, and he's crying over it, Yonadav, that rogue, he goes over to David and he says, no, don't worry, it's just Amnon, that disgusting son of yours who raped his sister. That's why Avshalom did it. What an opportunist. According to my interpretation, he is not just he's not being an opportunist. He is very upset with Amnon for not following along in the direction he had hoped based on his plan. And that's the rest falls through. In chapter 14, Avshalom is expelled from the land for killing his brother. And he tries very valiantly to get back into the country. He wants to be with his father. He misses his father. He spends 2 years in exile. Finally, he convinces Yoav, after burning Yoav's field, that the text, really, you feel a revulsion towards Avshalom already also. But Avshalom is expelled, and then that starts an insurrection in chapter 15, once he's invited back into the nation. And Mefarshim ask, how could a people so in love with David, they loved him very much by this time, how could they turn against him like this? And the answer Bravanel gives is that they really weren't turning against David at this time. This is David's 40th year. This is the very end of his kingdom. From chapter 15 to the very end is practically no time at all. It says in the beginning of his revolt, in the 40th year. The Mefarshim say the 40th year from when? Right, the 40th year of David's kingdom, which is the end of his kingdom. So the whole thing happens very quickly. And some say the 40th year from when they asked Shaul to be king, which means the 38th year of his kingdom. But Avshalom wants to stand in the place of a brother. Then he's convinced by Achitophel, who doesn't like David, to actually turn it into a full-fledged battle for the kingdom. Now, don't fight against your brother, potential brother. Fight against your father and kill him. And David is vastly outnumbered. It's amazing. He's forced to leave Yerushalayim, and he flees over the Yarden. And it's only through the heroic espionage of Hushai Ha'arki that Avshalom didn't kill David the night he wanted to. He took advice from Achitophel. Should I pounce on my father tonight or should I wait till tomorrow? Achitophel says, tonight! And the Tanakh says that when Achitophel gave advice, it was like asking the Urim B'Tumim. Obviously something Avshalom didn't know. But Avshalom then said, okay, Achitophel wants me to pounce tonight. Any other ideas? And then David and Avshalom looks at him. What? Hushai? What are you doing here? You're my father's best friend. And he says, I'm sorry. Everyone in Israel can see that you are going to be the next king. I want to put my coins in the slot that I think is going to work. So that doesn't actually appear that way. That's my own metaphor. But I want to side with the one I think is going to be the next king. So Avshalom, in the classic case of the pan calling the kettle black, he says, what kind of friend are you to turn against my father like this? Right? That's not a measure. That appears in the text. He probably wanted to assure that he goes, listen, your father is weak. I'm sorry, forgive me. Your father is afraid of you, but right now, tonight, he is actually waiting for you. And if you pounce tonight, he has the upper hand. When you're being attacked, obviously you know where your place is. If you attack him tonight, that's trouble. Wait a second. He has people helping him. Do not attack so quickly. And in fact, the Tanakh itself reveals that had he attacked that night, he would have killed David that night and all his men. So Hushai Ha'arki runs back to get the news back to David. You have some time. And by that time, things turned for David. Avshalom himself was caught. His long hair was caught in a thicket, which is the famous Mida Keneged Mida in the Mishnah in the Masechet Sota, that David, that Avshalom glorified in his long hair. He weighed it. He was a nazir, right? And then the hair was his undoing. And that was the Pyrrhic victory, because David wanted Avshalom alive. He was my son. I remember him sitting on my lap. I can't believe he really wanted to kill me. I'm sure someone else convinced him of that. When David heard that Avshalom was killed, Avshalom b'ni b'ni, mi yutein musi ani tachtecha, Avshalom b'ni b'ni. And Yoav comes and says, I don't get it. All these people here risked their lives to follow you in across the Yarden, and now he would have killed you and all of them if he survived. So don't make your friends your enemies and your enemies your friends. Go out and console your people. Go out in the balcony and talk to them and tell them that you're happy that they were on your side, and try to rebuild. And David does something smart, but it's the equivalence of Andrew Johnson after the Civil War, of making, let's say, Robert E. Lee the head of the Union Army afterwards. Who does David choose as the head of his army immediately after the Maaseh of Avshalom? Avshalom's chief general, Amasa. Amazing. He did not like Yoav at this point, because Yoav was the one who killed Avshalom. Why do you think that David allows Yoav to get away with so much in this book? I can't keep using the excuse because of Yoav's mother. You see, Yoav is the only one in Israel who... Okay, but he's the only one in Israel who knows how Uriah died. Remember, David sent him, I didn't say this before, but David sent him the note that said, send him to the front lines. Uriah, here, come on. And Uriah, by the way, was one of David's chief generals. At the end of Shmuel Bet, it lists his 37 generals. Uriah is among them. That's why he didn't think it was unusual to be called home to report on the war. He wasn't just a soldier, right? So Yoav has some goods on David, so David allows him. What happens is that as soon as David appoints Amasa as an act of reconstruction, I want to be king over everybody. I don't want to be the people who followed Avshalom to want to support someone else now. I want them to come back to me. So he appoints the head of that army to rule his army, which of course irks Yoav. He's taking away my job. Don't stand in the way of Yoav. Amasa quickly gets the Chomesh treatment too. All right. So that is the redemption. David returns to Yerushalayim. He rules over his kingdom again. He knows how to treat his friends like his friends, his enemies like his enemies, and he's taught right. By the way, the reader always thinks that Yoav is right. The reader thinks that, I mean, the Chazal should say Avner was a bigger tzaddik than Yoav, but the reader always thinks that Yoav is right. And that is the redemption of David. He's returned. And in this story, there's an unfortunate event that even as the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Nun Vav says, Kol Omer David Choto Eino Velatoa, admits to one sin of David's in this chapter, because Tziva, that man told to keep 35 men in charge of Mephibosheth, the cripple, he comes back and tells David, as David is returning to Yerushalayim, that Mephibosheth, you wouldn't believe it. He stayed in Yerushalayim, supported Absalom, was hoping that you and Absalom would kill each other, and that the reign would return to him as the sole survivor of Shaul. Oh, he was hoping to become king. And David, believe it or not, accepted this Lashon Hara. David said, that's real, it's true. Then all the fields I gave for Mephibosheth, everything I gave him is now yours, Tziva. Mephibosheth comes crawling out, his face not shaven, his prosthetics not on. He comes crawling to David out of Yerushalayim. He says, David, my king, what Tziva is saying about me is not true. So he goes, why did you remain in Yerushalayim? I'm crippled, I couldn't walk, I would have been a hindrance. And why aren't you clean shaven? And why don't you put on your prosthetics to meet your king? And he goes, I'm mourning for you until you return to Yerushalayim. Please, I he's lying about me. I would never chas v'sholom turn against you after all you've done for me. So David says, okay, yachloku, split the field. Half for you, half for Tziva. A heavenly voice comes down at that very moment, says the Gemara Yumat Avchav Beis, and says what? Irony, please. Split the kingdom. You can behave in such a impetuous manner without looking into the situation, just right there on the spot, say yachloku. All right, we'll see how your grandson behaves in a similarly impetuous manner, which will cause your kingdom to be divided in Sefer Melachim, as I said before. That leads to another mutiny, believe it or not. Sheva ben Bichri, it's not over! In between, there's Shimi ben Gera, who kicks him in Pana and then throws dust and rocks at him. And now there's another descendant of Binyamin, Sheva ben Bichri, who also rebels against David. And he's holed up into a town. And David says, this is a very famous halacha, Chayev Misa Kesheva ben Bichri. David says, I will destroy this whole town unless you give him up. There are halacha questions in Maseches Sanhedrin about doing, Yerushalmi Shvius about doing these kind of things. But David does it, and they give him up, and they kill Sheva ben Bichri immediately, and that ends that mutiny. In chapter 21, there's a three-year famine, and year after year, and David asks Hashem, why are so many people dying from this famine? Hashem says, because of a terrible, egregious sin committed against the house of Shaul. David looks into the situation and he's told, you have to appease the Givonim because of something that Shaul did. That is not found in Tanakh. Shaul did something terrible to Kohanim. No, what did he do to the Givonim? So the Gemara in Yevamos, the Vayin Tes, says that the Givonim served the Kohanim. Remember, Yahushua made them to be water carriers and woodcutters. So when the Kohanim were killed, some Givonim were killed, or they lost their parnosa. So the Gemara in Yevamos, the Vayin Tes, says, see, let the Gerim know that we care more about what happens to Gerim than even the Kohanim. And why do I write the word is vicarious here? Because David vicariously took seven descendants of Shaul to atone for what the Medrash says, seven Givonim who were killed in that battle. And he just took them. He saved Mephibosheth, the Gemara says, but he just gave over seven innocent. I mean, this mamish stands in the face of everything we know about the halachos of give me that one or I'll kill all of them or things of that sort. And David did it, but the famine ended afterwards. So David just gave over. The Givonim say, we don't want any money from Shaul, we just want Mida Keneged Mida. He killed seven of us, we want seven descendants of his. And he found seven descendants from Michal, from Merav, from children of Shaul, their children. And he gave over seven to be killed, and that is chapter 21. Chapter 22 and 23 contain various songs of David, very melodic, very euphonic. They have Shiras David, which is the Haftorah of Parshas Ha'azinu, when it's not Shabbos Shuva. And euphonic is just another word. There's Ksuvim Achronim, where it calls David Ne'im Zmiros Yisrael. Beautiful Zmiros that he sang. And finally, the very end does not end well for David. He enumerates the people. He wants to see how many people over whom he rules. Over a million people, and he's so proud. But hey, Yoav tells him, David, please, don't you know that you're not supposed to count? It's an Isser in the Torah. Where exactly that Isser appears is not quite clear. The Gemara in Yuma, which a lot of other Gemaras I've been quoting, Yuma Dav Chafal Chavbez a lot in this year, the Gemara in Yuma says it's actually from a pasuk in Hosea, or possibly some pesukim in the Torah, that you will not be able to count your descendants, Hashalo Yumad, Velo Yisofer. It says also, when David saw Shaul across the mountainous ridge, he said, if God had tempted me, I would have killed you. And Hashem says to him in Daf Samach Beis and Brachas, you call me a tempter? Chayecha, I'll tempt you to forget a mitzvah every child knows from the Torah. Because it says, Ki tisoros rosh bnei Yisrael, use a pikadon. You can't just count like this. Right? So David, Zunt, wants to rule over, so see how many people he rules over, and this causes a terrible famine, and the prophet's response is, I'll give you three choices for punishment. 3 days of pestilence, another famine, or be chased by your enemies. David's response is Tachanun. V'yomer David el God, Tzar li ma'od niflona bi'ad Hashem ki rabim rachamav uviyad odom ala pola. Radak asks, now I know why he didn't agree to be chased by his enemies. But why does this choose pestilence over famine? Because famine, a king can survive. He has lots of storehouses of food. But pestilence, kazeva kazetoch ala cheref. He has no unfair advantage with pestilence. So he chooses the pestilence. 70,000 people die the first day. And David comes out, these are psukim that make the Haggadah, right? With the sword, Cherev, Zuhadever, Kemosh Nemar. So he holds up his, he comes out to Hashem and says, kill me, not these sheep! Right, Chazal said that it's just Avishai, Yoav's brother who died, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. But Pshuto is Pshuto. A lot of people died in this pestilence. And Hashem instructs David, if you want to end this pestilence, go up to that mountain, buy that land, and take it for a holy place. And he ends Shmuel Beis by buying the land where the Beis HaMikdash will be built. He pays 50 shkolim for it, and Divrei Yomim, it's 600 shkolim, not because of inflation, because David wanted all the shvatim to be involved in the purchase of this area. And that ends Shmuel Beis. And now I take you to 24 words. David was acting in a doleful way because of the death of Shaul and his sons. There was a competition. They behaved in a competitive manner to see which tribe is better to secure us from the Plishtim. And in chapter 3, Avner was very conciliatory with David to agree to come to his side. And that caused the regicide, the killing of a king by Rechav and Baanah against Ishbosheth. David then, therefore, was able to be imperial and rule over all of Israel alone. That led to his bringing the Aron back, but there was an impediment. It fell, and Uzzah died, and David stopped the procession. He behaved in a very magnanimous way to the prophet who had first told him that he could build the Beis HaMikdash, but then he was told he could not. David acts in a pugilistic way, a warlike way, in chapter 8 against the Moabites. We have to switch 7 and 8 around because of that, because 7 says that David had no more wars to fight. He gave recompense to Mephibosheth for his promise to Yonasan and took care of him. The insolence of the Ammonites, in shaving half the beard and cutting off their pants, led to the war with Ammon. in which David saw Bathsheba and acted very impulsively. He should have turned away when the Yetzer Hara was just a Helech or an Oreach, and that caused Nathan to come to him and to accuse him. He was accusative over David, and he punished him in the two ways, as I mentioned. And that starts the rest of the other column, the repulsiveness of Amnon by taking his sister, the expulsion of Avshalom in his insurrection, and the revulsion over, I actually skipped this before, but the revulsion of Avshalom of making himself to be reviled by David and by the entire nation. He took 10 wives of David up to a roof and raped them there to show everyone the other revulsion I have of my father and that he should have of me. The espionage of Hushai Ha'arki, the double agent. The Pyrrhic victory of David defeating Avshalom, but Avshalom dies. The redemption of David's return and what he did with Mephibosheth and Ziba. The mutiny, chapter 20, of Sheba ben Bichri, the vicarious decision of David to kill the 7 descendants of Shaul, the melodic and euphonic description of David's last songs, and finally the enumeration of the people at the end of Shmuel Beis that caused that last tragic end. But it did lead to the purchase of the land of the Beis HaMikdash.